So we have a slight change of mode this evening, since it's Ajahn Chah's death anniversary day. So we'll have I've got some readings from this Recollections of Ajahn Chah, which was published last year.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
This book was compiled from a number of different sources. There were particular interviews that were done by Ajahn Kongrit with various senior members of the community to ask what was our most significant or impactful memory of our time with Lompo Cha, and others were articles from the Forest Sangha newsletter that happened over the years and have been incorporated here. So I'll just use a few of these readings. And the first one that I will do is from Ajahn Chayasaro. So I'll just read the little introductory note here. June the 17th, that would have been of 1989. June the 17th was the 71st birthday of Venerable Ajahn Chah, spiritual teacher of over 80 forest monasteries in Thailand, Britain, and around the world. As is customary in the monasteries in England, the day's practice was offered in gratitude to him and for his well-being. In this newsletter, we present, through some reflections, an occasion for readers to recollect what he has made possible for all of us. Venerable Jayasaro was formerly abbot of Wat Phananachat. In 1988, he visited the UK as a translator for Venerable Chakun Panyananta. The following reflections on Ajahn Chah's life are taken from a talk given at Amaravati Buddhist Center in June of that year by Ajahn Jayasaro. My own first meeting with Ajahn Chah was on the full moon of December 1978. I had spent the rains retreat of that year as an 8-precept layperson with Ajahn Sumedho at Oakenholt in England. After the retreat, I went out to Thailand. When I arrived at Wat Bapong, Venerable Pumuto, an Australian monk resident there at that time, took me to see Ajahn Chah. He was sitting under his kutti having a drink. Not scotch. He looked at me and smiled very warmly. He held out the drink he had in his hand, so I crawled over and took it. As I returned to my place, I found there were tears welling up in my eyes. I was emotionally overcome for quite a while. Since that day, I don't think I've ever wanted to leave the monastery or do anything except be a disciple of Ajahn Chah. People often presumed there would be a problem with language for Westerners who wanted to stay at the monastery, but this was not the case. Someone once asked Ajahn Chah, "Lumpo, how do you teach all your Western disciples? Do you speak English or French? Do you speak Japanese or German?" "No," replied Ajahn Chah. "Then how do they all manage?" He asked, "Householder, at your home, do you have water buffaloes?" "Yes, Lumpur," was the reply. "Do you have any cows or dogs or chickens?" "Yes, Lumpur." "Tell me," Lumpur asked, "do you speak water buffalo? Do you speak cow?" "No," the householder replied. "Well, how do they all manage?" Language was not so important to Lumpur. He knew how to see through the exterior trappings of language and culture. He could see how all minds basically revolve around the same old centers of greed, hatred, and delusion. His method of training was one of pointing directly at the way our minds work. He was always showing us how craving gives rise to suffering, actually allowing us to see the Four Noble Truths directly. And for him, the way of exposing desires was to frustrate them. In his vocabulary, the words to teach and to torment were more or less interchangeable. So that's the Thai word for torment is toraman. So toraman looks it and swan looks it means that to torture your disciples is synonymous with teaching your disciples. So You guys get it so soft here. Such training as this can only take place if everyone in the monastery has great confidence in the teacher. If there is the slightest suspicion that he might be doing it out of aversion or desire for power, there wouldn't be any benefit. In Ajahn Chah's case, everyone could see that he had the greatest courage and fortitude, and so could trust that he was doing it out of compassion. Primarily, he would teach about letting go, but he also taught a lot about what to do when we can't let go. We endure, he would say. Usually people could appreciate intellectually about letting go, but when faced with obstacles, they couldn't do it. The teaching of patient endurance was a central aspect of the way that he taught. He continually changed routines around in the monastery so you wouldn't become stuck in ruts. As a result, you kept finding yourself not quite knowing where you stood, and he would always be there watching, so you couldn't be too heedless. This is one of the great values of living with a teacher. One feels the need to be mindful. In looking into Ajahn Chah's early life, it was inspiring for me to find just how many problems he had. Biographies of some of the great masters leave you with the impression that they were perfectly pure from the age of 8 or 9, that they didn't have to work at their practice. But for Ajahn Chah, practice was very difficult. For one thing, he had a lot of sensual desire. He also had a great deal of desire for beautiful requisites, such as his bowl and robes, etc. He made a resolution in working with these tendencies that he would never ask for anything, even if it was permitted to do so by the discipline. He related how once his robes had been falling to bits. His underrobe was worn paper thin, so he had to walk very carefully lest it split. Then one day he heedlessly squatted down and it tore completely. He didn't have any cloth to patch it, but he remembered the foot wiping cloths in the meeting hall, so he took them away, washed them, and patched his robe with them. In later times, when he had disciples, he excelled in skillful means for helping them. He had had so many problems himself. In another story, he related how he made a resolution to really work with sensual desire. He resolved that for the 3 months' rains retreat, he would not look at a woman. Being very strong-willed, he was able to keep to this. On the last day of the retreat, many people came to the monastery to make offerings. He thought, I've done it now for 3 months. Let's see what happens. He looked up, and at that moment, there was a young woman right in front of him. He said the impact was being like hit by lightning. It was then that he realized mere sense restraint, although essential, was not enough. No matter how restrained one might be regarding the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, if there wasn't wisdom to understand the actual nature of desire, then freedom from it was impossible. He was always stressing the importance of wisdom, not just restraint, but mindfulness and contemplation. Throwing oneself into practice with great gusto and little reflective ability may result in a strong concentration practice, but one eventually ends up in despair. Monks practicing like this usually come to a point where they decide that they don't have what it takes to break through in this lifetime, and then they disrobe. He emphasized that continuous effort was much more important than making a great effort for a short while, only to let it all slide. Day in, day out, month in, year out. That's the real skill of the practice. What is needed in mindfulness practice, he taught, is a constant awareness of what one is thinking, doing, or saying. It's not a matter of being on retreat or off retreat, or on being in a monastery or out wandering on Tudong. It's a matter of constancy. What am I doing now? Why am I doing it? Constantly looking to see what is happening in the present moment. Is this mind state coarse or refined? At the beginning of practice, he said, our mindfulness is intermittent, like water dripping from a tap. But as we continue, the intervals between the drips lessen and eventually they become a stream. This stream of mindfulness is what we're aiming for. It was noticeable that he didn't talk a lot about levels of enlightenment or the various stages of concentration, jhana. He was aware of how people tend to attach to these terms and conceive of practice as going from this stage to that. Once someone asked him if such and such a person was an arahant, was enlightened. He answered, if they are, then they are. If they're not, then they're not. You are what you are, and you're not like them. So just do your own practice. He was very short with such questions. When people asked him about his own attainments, he never spoke praising himself or making any claim whatsoever. When talking about the foolishness of people, he wouldn't say, you think like this and you think like that, or you do this and you do that. Rather, he would always say, we do this and we do that. The skill of speaking in such a personal manner meant that those listening regularly came away feeling he was talking directly to them. Also, it often happened that people would come with personal problems they wanted to discuss with him, and that very same evening he would give a talk covering exactly that subject. In setting up his monasteries, he took a lot of his ideas from the great meditation teacher Venerable Ajahn Mun, but also from other places he encountered during his years of wandering. Also, he laid great emphasis on a sense of community. In one section of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha speaks about the welfare of the Sangha being dependent on meeting frequently and in large numbers, in harmony, and on discussing things together. Ajahn Chah stressed this a lot. The bhikkhu discipline, the Vinaya, was to Ajahn Chah a very important tool for training. He had found it so in his own practice. Often he would give talks on it until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. The bell would then ring at 3 for the morning chanting. The monks were sometimes afraid to go back to their kutis, lest they couldn't wake up, so they just go and lean against a tree. Those were the days. Of course, there are ants climbing up and down the tree as well, which he had to negotiate with. Especially the pillars in the meditation hall were more reliable than the trees. So. Especially in the early days of his teaching, things were very difficult. Even basic requisites like lanterns and torches were very rare. In those days, the forest was dark and thick with many wild and dangerous animals. Late at night, you could hear the monks going back to their huts, making a loud noise, stomping and chanting at the same time. On one occasion, 20 torches were given to the monastery, but as soon as the batteries ran out, they all came back into the stores, as there were no new batteries to replace them. Sometimes Ajahn Chah was very harsh on those who lived with him. He admitted himself that he had an advantage over his disciples. He said that when his mind entered samadhi concentration for only 30 minutes, it could be the same as having slept all night. Sometimes he literally talked for hours, going over and over the same things again and again, telling you the same story hundreds of times. For him, each time was as if it was the first. He'd be sitting there giggling and chuckling away, and everyone else would be looking at the clock and wondering when he would let them go. Some things don't change, do they? It seemed that he had a special soft spot for those who suffered a lot. This often meant the Western monks. There was one English monk, Venerable Titapo, to whom he gave a lot of attention. That means he tormented him terribly. I knew him very well, Titapo. So. One day there was a large gathering of visitors at the monastery, and as often happened, Ajahn Chah was praising the Western monks to the Thais as a way of teaching them. He was saying how clever the Westerners were, all the things they could do, and what good disciples they were. All, he said, except this one, pointing to Venerable Titapo. He's really stupid. Another day he asked Venerable Titapo, do you get angry when I treat you like this? Venerable Titapo replied, what use would it be? It would be like getting angry at a mountain. Good answer. Several times people suggested to Ajahn Chah that he was like a Zen master. No, I'm not, he would say. I'm like Ajahn Chah. There was a Korean monk visiting once who liked to ask him koans. Ajahn Chah was completely baffled. He thought they were jokes. You could see how it was necessary to know the rules of the game before you could give it the right answers. One day this monk told Ajahn Chah the Zen story about the flag and the wind and asked, "Is it the flag that blows or is it the wind?" Ajahn Chah answered, "It's neither, it's the mind." The Korean monk thought that was wonderful and immediately bowed to Ajahn Chah, which is also the same answer that that account is from the story of Huineng, a great Chinese master, the sixth Zen patriarch, and it was exactly the same answer that Huineng gave. He was a layman who showed up at this Dharma assembly, and these two monks were debating about whether it was the flag that was moving or whether it was the wind. And he said, "Venerable sirs, it's neither the flag or the wind is moving, it's your minds that are moving." So Lompo Chog had the same answer as Huineng. The Korean monk thought that was wonderful and immediately bowed to Ajahn Chah, but then Ajahn Chah said he just read the story in the Thai translation of Huineng. Just in case you were thinking, wow. Ajahn Buddhadasa had to put it into Thai. Many of us tend to confuse complexity with profundity. So, Ajahn Chah liked to show how profundity was in fact simplicity. The truth of impermanence is the most simple thing in the world, and yet it's the most profound. He really emphasized that. He said the key to living in the world with wisdom is a regular recollection of the changing nature of things. Nothing is sure, he would constantly remind us. He was always using this expression in Thai, mein nair, meaning uncertain. He said this teaching, it's not certain, sums up all the wisdom of Buddhism. He emphasized that in meditation, we can't go beyond the hindrances unless we really understand them. This means knowing their impermanence. Often he talked about killing the defilements, quote unquote, and this also meant seeing their impermanence. Killing defilements, in Thai that's ka kile, is an idiomatic expression in the meditative forest tradition of northeast Thailand. It means that by seeing with penetrative clarity the actual nature of defilements, you go beyond them. While it was considered the job of a bhikkhu in this tradition to be dedicated to formal practice, that didn't mean that there wasn't work to do. When work needed doing, you did it, and you didn't make a fuss. Work is not any different from formal practice if one knows the principles properly. The same principles apply in both cases, as the same body and mind are active. And in Ajahn Chah's monasteries, when the monks worked, they really worked. One time, he wanted a road built up to Wat Thum Sang Phet Mountain Monastery, and the Highways Department offered to help. But before long, they pulled out, so Ajahn Chah took the monks up there to do it. Everybody worked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 3 o'clock the next morning. Nighttime is cooler for working. A rest was allowed until just after 5, and they'd head off down the hill to the village on alms round. After the meal, they could rest again until 3, before starting work once more. But nobody ever saw Ajahn Chah take a rest. He was busy receiving people who came to visit, and when it was time for work, he didn't just direct it. He joined in the heavy lifting, carrying rocks alongside everyone else. That was always very inspiring for the monks to see. Hauling water from the well, sweeping and so on, he was always there, right up until the time when his health began to fail. Ajahn Chah wasn't always popular in his province in northeast Thailand, even though he did bring about many major changes in the lives of the people. There was a great deal of animism and superstition in their belief systems. Very few people practiced meditation, out of fear that it would drive them crazy. There was more interest in magical powers and psychic phenomena than in Buddhism. A lot of killing of animals was done in the pursuit of merit. Ajahn Chah was often very outspoken on such issues, so he had many enemies. Nevertheless, there were always many who loved him, and it was clear that he never played on that. In fact, if any of his disciples were getting too close, he would send them away. Sometimes monks became attached to him, and he promptly sent them off to some other monastery. Charismatic as he was, he always stressed the importance of the Sangha, of community spirit. I think it was because Ajahn Chah was, quote, nobody in particular, that he could be anybody he chose. If he felt it was necessary to be fierce, he could be that. If he felt that somebody would benefit from warmth and kindness, then he'd give them. If you had the feeling he would be whatever it was helpful for the person he was with. And he was very clear about the proper understanding of conventions. Someone once asked about the relative merits of arahants and bodhisattvas. He answered, don't be an arahant, don't be a bodhisattva, don't be anything at all. If you're an arahant, you'll suffer. If you're a bodhisattva, you'll suffer. If you're anything at all, you will suffer. I had the feeling that Ajahn Chah wasn't anything at all. The quality in him which inspired awe was the light of Dhamma he reflected. It wasn't exactly him as a person. So since first meeting Ajahn Chah, I've had an unshakable conviction that this way is truly possible. It works. It's good enough. And I found a willingness to acknowledge that if there are any problems, it's me who's creating them. It's not the form and it's not the teachings. This appreciation made things a lot easier. It's important that we're able to learn from all the ups and downs we have in practice. It's important that we come to know how to be a refuge unto ourselves, to see clearly for ourselves. When I consider the morass of selfishness and foolishness my life could have been, and then reflect on the teachings and benefits I've received, I find I really want to dedicate my life to being a credit to my teacher. This reflection has been a great source of strength. This is one form of Sanghanusati, recollection of the Sangha, recollection of the great debt we owe our teachers. So, I trust that you may find this is some help. I trust that you may find this is of some help in your practice. So, there's some Actually, I was given right here in this spot in 1988. I think I was present when he gave that talk. And this is some reflections from Ajahn Khemanando, who was ordained as a monk at the same time as Ajahn Jayasaro. Most of my own personal experience of Ajahn Chah comes from the period beginning January 1979, when I came to stay at Wat Bapong as a layman, followed by many months as an anagarika. I was a newcomer to Thailand in monastic life and spoke or understood very little Thai, being quite dependent on the more senior Western monks for translations and explanations of what was happening. So my impressions from that time were not so much of profound dialogues or specific instructions on meditation, but more revelations of Ajahn Chah's character, which would often overturn my own preconceptions about the nature of an enlightened being, whilst also, sometimes simultaneously, providing evidence that he did indeed function on quite a different level from the people by whom he was surrounded. Apparently small incidents in which Ajahn Chah would do things that didn't need explaining, which I was able to observe... Apparently small incidents in which Ajahn Chah would do things that didn't need explaining, which I was able to observe to gain some food for thought. Once I and a fellow Anagarika, a New Zealander, were whiling away a hot, steamy afternoon in idle conversation on the balcony of my kuti. Also, when I was a newly ordained monk, Ajahn Khemanando was an Anagarika, so I used to go around for hibiscus tea, or real tea if we could get it. I was a regular visitor at his kuti for surreptitious cups of tea in the afternoon. Anyway, once I and a fellow Anagarika, a New Zealander, were whiling away a hot, steamy afternoon in idle conversation on the balcony of my kuti. At Wat Bapong in those days, much of the formal practice was done as a group activity in the main hall morning and evening, while the individual kuti was kind of sacrosanct, where you could expect to be left to your own devices most of the time. We had adjacent kutis in a far corner of the monastery and had become friends, offering each other companionship and support in this way, basically relaxing, goofing off. So you can imagine how surprised and guilty we felt when Ajahn Chah himself suddenly appeared on the path to the kuti, calling out and beckoning with his hand. We thought we were in for a scolding, for not meditating diligently, but Ajahn Chah didn't seem bothered at all. He wasn't telling us to stop talking, but calling us, "Come here, come here." It transpired that Ajahn Chah was taking time off from being the resident sage of Wat Bapong, receiving a constant stream of visitors at his kuti, and had decided to go hunting for monitor lizards instead. Monitor lizards, these big wild lizards that live in the forest. Having just spotted one in the vicinity, he had come to enlist our help, patiently miming an explanation of how to fix a string snare to the end of a bamboo pole. Ajahn Chah was very fond of the forest chickens, which he would feed with rice in the area around his own kuti. He wanted to protect them from their natural enemy, the large monitor lizards, which liked to eat their eggs. So there followed what turned out to be a hilarious scene of two rather clumsy, inexperienced Westerners, goaded on by an enthusiastic Ajahn Chah, their adopted spiritual guide, thrashing around in the forest, trying to catch a big lizard. Hardly the sort of thing that I'd imagined writing home about. We were quite hopeless, of course, and eventually gave up without catching anything, but not before having a good laugh at ourselves. What struck me most about this little episode was the contrast between Ajahn Chah the lizard hunter, displaying a very natural spontaneity and down-to-earth, almost childlike simplicity and humour, and the awe-inspiring formality of his role as the head of a large, important monastery, which up to that point was all I'd ever seen of him. This had the effect of undermining many of my own preconceptions regarding what a great enlightened teacher was supposed to be like, and helped me to see that Ajahn Chah was actually very natural and quite funny. So I was able to feel less intimidated and more relaxed in being around him. I spent the Vasa of that year, the rains retreat, as an Anagarika with Ajahn Chah, when he unexpectedly decided to leave Wat Bapong for the monastery in his home village, Wat Khor Nok, 3 kilometres away. He'd just been donated the village monastery to be a branch, and he decided he would go and stay there to have a bit of a quieter time and sort of get the monastery refurbished. I was the most junior of the 4 foreign disciples who accompanied Ajahn Chah at that time for what turned out to be a unique rains retreat. So there were no Thai monks or novices there. It was just the 2 Western monks, 1 Western novice, and then Ajahn Khemanando as a Western Anagarika. So it was just 5 of them together there in the monastery for that rains retreat. He gave some very profound Dhamma talks during this Vasa in response to specific questions by more senior Western monks who took advantage of his increased accessibility in such a small place. Most of this was over my head at the time, and my time was still pretty minimal, and I was for the most part preoccupied with various chores, cleaning spittoons, etc. Such was my lowly position. Ajahn Chah had come to this little monastery specifically to renovate it, and soon set about building a new sala. He was often to be seen supervising the work in progress, strutting about with his big walking stick, barking out comments and commands in a most imperious manner, displaying what appeared to be dissatisfaction, irritation, or even anger. It was really quite intimidating to watch, and I was starting to get a bit put off by it all. When Ajahn Chah seemed to notice that I was having a few doubts about this performance, he looked across at me and, by way of reassurance, pointed to the centre of his chest and said, "Nothing here, nothing here." I realized then that he was actually a consummate actor and could display behavior without being affected at all by it. He was simply doing what was necessary to get the right response from the village workers, who are culturally conditioned to respond to that kind of expression of authority. Another time I witnessed him metamorphose into a really friendly, jovial old uncle or grandfather in response to a visiting family group. A most saccharine performance that at the time struck me as transparently artificial. But on reflection, I could see that it was in fact just right for those people in that situation, and they departed, happy and uplifted. Through experiences like these, I learnt to let go of fixed views about how supposedly enlightened people should or should not act. Ajahn Chah was very skillful in adapting to circumstances for the sake of inspiring or teaching others, and this indicated a highly developed mind. But an unenlightened observer of such outward behaviour cannot see the true quality of a mind like that. The purity or lack of defilement cannot be seen directly. All that can be seen is an apparently normal person displaying normal characteristics and reactions. So we should be very cautious about jumping to conclusions or passing judgments based on such superficial observations. As the Buddha pointed out, it's very difficult for an unenlightened person to know the quality of a wise person. It needs keen observation over a long period of time. A very important point. Visiting Ajahn Chah back at Wat Bapong after that Vasa, I found him directing a contingent of young conscript soldiers who had come to help clean up the monastery, sweeping, picking up leaves, etc. There he was, sitting in his wicker chair, waving his stick and bellowing orders left, right and centre. Seeing it was me who had come to sit beside him under his kuti, he made an oblique reference to the previous encounter at Wat Khor Nok by leaning over and saying with a little grin, "You can't talk to Westerners like that, can you?" I was impressed by how much he seemed to understand the character of Westerners and the problems they had in undertaking the monastic training. Although he spoke most of the time in the appropriate way for Thais, who were conditioned to respond to authority like that, yet he was adaptable and quick enough to pick up the ways of dealing with Westerners, even those who couldn't understand his language. The villagers were always amazed by how Ajahn Chah, who had very little in the way of formal education or worldly sophistication, could actually teach so many Western disciples without even speaking English. Ajahn Chah would simply point out that they themselves were raising chickens and buffalo all the time without knowing their language and were managing all right. He was very observant and could quite accurately assess the personality of approaching newcomers by watching their faces, their postures, and the way they walked, etc. Before they'd even sat down or said anything, Ajahn Chah would make a remark to those present, such as, "This one's full of doubt," which subsequent conversation would reveal to be true. More than anything else, I think it was probably his humour that made him attractive to Westerners, for whom conceit, views and attachment to all sorts of worldly knowledge and sophistication could be serious obstructions. But Ajahn Chah would have means of deflating all that in a humorous way. It's very difficult to point out somebody's defilements in an acceptable way that doesn't cause offence or inspire resistance or rejection. But Westerners generally have a rather sarcastic sense of humour, and Ajahn Chah would play on that with his own wit and make people aware of their own faults in a very funny way, which would in turn endear him to them even more. Most of the time I was actually with Ajahn Chah, I didn't understand Thai very well at all. And just as I was getting competent in the language, he got sick and was incapacitated to the point of being unable to speak. But although the tapes and books produced in later times made me aware of what I'd missed experiencing personally, I feel no regret about it. Because after being a monk for so many years now, I really believe that the initiation into spiritual life of those early years gave me something that has sustained me right up to the present. Basically, the simple conviction that this is right. It works. It's all you need. This conviction sprang directly from my own experience of Ajahn Chah's example. This person who seemed to have such cast-iron integrity, who conveyed complete certainty and a kind of natural authority that commanded respect. Confronted almost daily by all kinds of people, problems and questions, he was quite unshaken from this position of inner certainty and calm. No one could upset him or make him change his position, and this was most impressive. I'd never seen anyone so constant, and it seemed to be proof that he was operating on quite a different level from the average person. So, although I can't really claim to have had profound discussions or deep personal connection with Ajahn Chah, just the constancy of his presence was enough to anchor me to the principles of the training he taught. And it inspired great confidence to have an example of someone who had achieved such results from the practice, who embodied the Dhamma and lived it all the time. Consequently, I never really had doubts about it or any problems in surrendering myself to it. I'd never had a teacher before or much understanding of what that might imply, and was also a fairly critical person with a rather cynical bent. Still has. But the example of Ajahn Chah himself made the surrender of opinions and preferences, the endurance of simplicity and austerity, the tribulations of diet and climate, etc., a joy to undertake. Without such an example as a constant reminder, it's very easy to remain stuck in one's own views and opinions, which is a major obstacle to success in training. Westerners especially have problems because they know so much. They know that there are other teachers, other traditions, and books all over the place, and they can just get lost, never really grasping the point of it all. Ajahn Chah would say, "Don't read books. Don't write home more than twice a year. You come here to die." As often that would be his very first question when you arrived. You come all the way from Portugal or the Massachusetts and from Vienna. And I've come to be your student. He said, "Well, have you come here to die?" I was thinking of becoming enlightened. Well, if you haven't come here to die, you better go home. Get back on the plane. But I'm only interested in people who come to die here. The idea of living in the forest and being really simple appealed to me, as my character naturally disposes me to be that way. It was no great wrench to take up the forest life. It's often assumed that living with a teacher means having an in-depth personal rapport, characterized by weighty discussions of profound topics pertaining to spiritual life and the highest goals thereof. But that's not necessarily the case. You never really enter spiritual life wholeheartedly until you surrender yourself, surrender views and opinions. Ajahn Chah's genius was in his ability to point this out, orchestrating an environment or training situation in which people could become aware of their own defilements and learn not to believe their own thinking. This is incredibly important. Without the example of someone who's done it, who lives it, it's really difficult to give up self-concern. I never had any problems wondering whether I should be doing this or whether I should go somewhere else. Inspired by Ajahn Chah's example, I just got on with it. I didn't see any point in going anywhere else. Eventually, you verify the teaching through your own practice. You realize how things change. Your habits change. Your character changes. Your defilements get less. Life gets easier and your mind is more peaceful. Everything Ajahn Chah has been saying is true. And then the last couple I'll do is one from Lumpur Sumato, first of all. This is describing an incident from his early days with Ajahn Chah in the late 60s. In those days, I was a very junior monk, and one night Ajahn Chah took us to a village fete. I think Satimanta was there at the time. He was an American bhikkhu in that era. Now, we were all very serious practitioners and didn't want any kind of frivolity or foolishness. So, of course, going to a village fete was the last thing we wanted to do, because in these villages, they love loudspeakers. Anyway, Ajahn Chah took Satimanta and I to this village fete, and we had to sit up all night with all the raucous sounds of the loudspeakers going and monks giving talks all night long. I kept thinking, "Oh, I want to get back to my cave. Green-skinned monsters and ghosts are much better than this." I noticed that Satimanta, who was incredibly serious, was looking angry and critical and very unhappy. So we sat there looking miserable, and I thought, "Why does Ajahn Chah bring us to these things?" Then I began to see for myself. I remember sitting there thinking, "Here I am getting all upset over this. Is it that bad? What's really bad is what I'm making out of it. What's really miserable is my mind. Loudspeakers and noise, distraction and sleepiness, all that one can really put up with. It's that awful thing in my mind that hates it, resents it, and wants to leave." That evening I could really see what misery I could create in my mind over things that one can bear. I remember that as a very clear insight of what I thought was miserable and what really is miserable. At first I was blaming the people and the loudspeakers and the disruption, the noise and the discomfort. I thought that was the problem. Then I realized that it wasn't. It was my mind that was miserable. And then lastly, Ajahn Chandasiri. Ajahn Chandasiri first met Lumpur Cha while still a laywoman during his second visit to England in 1979. For me, one of the most striking things about Lumpur Cha was the effect of his presence on those around him. Watching Ajahn Sumedho, who hitherto had been for me a somewhat awe-inspiring teacher, sit at his feet with an attitude of sheer delight, devotion, and adoration, it lingers in my mind as a memory of extraordinary sweetness. Ajahn Chah would tease him, "Oh, maybe it's time for you to come back to Thailand, Sumedho." Everyone gasped inwardly, "Is he serious?" Later on, a visitor, a professional flautist, began to ask about music. "What about Bach? Surely there's nothing wrong with that. Much of his music is very spiritual, not at all worldly." It was a question that interested me greatly. Ajahn Chah looked at her, and when she'd finished, he said quietly, "Yes, but the music of the peaceful heart is much, much more beautiful." There's a fellow who comes on the 10-day retreats here who's a musician, a classical musician, and during the interview, during a question and answer session, he said, "You know, you keep saying that, you know, everything is unsatisfactory, but really, I have to take issue with you on this, because Bach is in a different category." And we had this whole interesting discussion about how Bach was not unsatisfactory, in his view. So I was trying to point out that it's the attachment to it that causes the problems. So these are wonderful stories, so we have many copies of this here on the shelves, and is available as people would like to get their own copy. I think it was quite an inspired idea to create that as a book, as a collection. So not so much Ajahn Chah speaking in his own voice, even translated into English, but those of us who were around him and sort of imbibed his teaching directly, and what impact it had on us. And what's really interesting, obviously we've lived as a community and we know each other pretty well over the years, but it is striking how many of us have the same things that we are touched by, and in particular how there's this quality of changeability. And I was reading this morning at the mid morning sitting a piece from Ajahn Tiridhammo about how there was no fixed Ajahn Chah, that it was just. Because Ajahn Tiridhammo had been to a few other teachers in Thailand and was used to this idea, this teacher, and this is his method, and this is, you know, his sort of standard spiel, and this is what he says, and this is the technique, and then this other teacher has a different technique. And then sitting around listening to Ajahn Chah, he's like, well, he's totally inconsistent. He says one thing to one person, something else to someone else, and what's his method? What's his, you know, there's nothing solid there. And then he realized, oh, right, there's nothing solid there. There is no consistent Ajahn Chah. And in the similar passage, Ajahn Sujito says almost exactly the same thing, and they hadn't conferred on any of these. And many of us had that kind of impression. And in the recollection of one of the things that I said in there is how one time, when I was either a novice or a very new monk at Wat Pa Phong, and I was only together with Ajahn Chah for a total of about 3 weeks altogether over the 2 years I was in Thailand. This particular time I was at Wat Pa Phong, and some visitors had come, and so Ajahn Chah's kuti was over in one part of the central area of the monastery, and then the main sala was at the end of the drive about 200 yards away. And so I'd been over by the main sala, and this large group of people had come in a bus. And one of the senior monks, Ajahn Chu, had received them and said, "Oh, could you go and tell Lumpur there's a group of visitors have come and they'd like to see him if possible." So it was quite a big crowd, so I think they thought meet them in the sala. So I went over to Ajahn Chah's kuti, and it was a very rare situation where he was sitting under the kuti by himself, and there was no one else around. There was no other visitors, and he was just sitting there by himself on this wicker bench that he sat on. And I thought, and I was a very anxious type, and my tie was almost non-existent. I thought, oh dear, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Oh gosh, he's meditating. Oh, I don't want to disturb him. Oh, what should I do? What should I do? So then I sort of turned around and started to go back, and so I'll just tell Ajahn Chah so that Ajahn Chah could go and disturb him. And then I turned around again. I thought, no, he'll just tell me to go back and get Long Paul. So, okay, I'll just, but what should I do? So I kind of knelt down. I kind of cleared my throat and put his... absolutely no response. And so I said, yeah, Long Paul? There's no response. And then I said, Long Paul? And then he opened his eyes, and there was this extraordinary experience of him looking at me, and there was absolutely nobody there. It was like he was looking right in my face, and there was no one there. And then he said, Arai. What? And then it was like this person arrived. Like suddenly, and it was the most extraordinary experience where he was just, his mind was obviously completely empty. And then he sort of connected with me as this sort of nervous novice addressing him. And then whoops, this entity, Ajahn Chah, arrived. And I said, oh, Lumpo, some visitors have arrived. And Ajahn Chah asked if you can go and receive them at the sala. And he said, okay, I can go and see them. But it was the most extraordinary experience of like watching a being come into existence. Like there was nobody there, and then suddenly there was this personality arrived. Like he was, as if he was sort of putting on a mask or adopting the role. So it was very much that feeling of, okay, well, they want me to do the Ajahn Chah thing. Okay, I can do that. It was almost like he sort of incarnated. I sort of put on the persona, which literally means a mask. That's what the word means. Persona is the Latin word for a mask. So he literally sort of put on the Ajahn Chah persona to go and do the human thing. But that was very indicative of that quality of emptiness and sort of spaciousness within him, that he was really totally, he wasn't like a, sort of going around being a person, sort of, I'm being a person adapting to situations. It was almost like he wasn't really a person. But he just sort of put on the persona in order to communicate and to teach. And so that so many of us had that experience, like Ajahn Khemananda was saying how, he could be this like, don't put the bricks over there, you fool. Put them, no, don't stack them like that, stack them like this. And then just sort of... giving you the wink that he's not really upset or angry or agitated at all, but just that's how you talk to get a certain job done. And that kind of incredible adaptability within himself, and also that sense of nothing disturbing him, that that things couldn't upset him. And Lumpur Sumedho would often say, I really do think a bomb could go off in the room and he wouldn't be upset or disturbed by it. You say that as a kind of an expression, oh, a bomb could go off and it wouldn't. But I think actually it wouldn't. And that kind of adaptability and readiness for anything is like a mind that's not hanging on to anything or not trying to be anything or not trying to prove anything to anybody. That was what touched so many of us and was such a powerful... medium for learning. And as the several of them and those accounts say that he was incredibly witty, even though he couldn't speak your own language. He was saying in that last piece from Ajahn Khemananda about he would just say, oh, this one's full of doubt, or oh, this is a very important person. just by the way they carried themselves, or the way how they sat down, or the way they were sort of relating to the people who arrived with them. And I remember one time somebody said, "You know, Lumpur, are you psychic? You must be able to read people's minds because you always seem to be able to gauge exactly what to say to different people." And he said, "No, not in the slightest." But if you just watch somebody walking across the room, you can learn everything you need to know about somebody just by watching them walk across the yard, you know, to see how they enter the room, and it tells you everything. So it was really just his capacity to be observant, as observing body language and the way people function. Yeah, okay, when it's time to do work, who arrives first? Yeah, who's looking out and tidying up after other people? Who's already reaching for the tool that you need before you've asked for it? You know, who's already disappeared before the work project has finished? You know? Yeah, who's always arriving late? You know, how are people operating? And so he would just notice that, and would be just keeping his eyes open, and then seeing how people were, then he would respond to that. So he knew when he was giving Titapo a bad time. That that was something that he would really appreciate. he would take that as a sign of affection, that he's giving him a difficult time, and that it was something that was useful and beneficial to him. So he would always gauge where people were, and other people who were like, who had a very different character. Like there was a French novice who was there at the same time as me, who was very, very seriously minded and had almost no sense of humour at all. And Ajahn Chah never teased him, ever. Because he knew he couldn't handle it. It wasn't his thing. And so he was always very gentle and very straightforward and respectful when we spoke to him. Because he knew if you tease this one, you know, he'll just crack. He just won't know what to do with it. Whereas someone like Tanti Tapo is like, yeah, the more mistreatment, the better. You know, because he could see that was a means that would really help him. But the other one, that is Gino Waro, he knew that he was very, very serious, and that he couldn't relate to things through that aspect of humor. He couldn't laugh at himself. Yeah, everything was very serious. So Lumpur helped him through gentleness rather than humor. So it was quite an extraordinary and unique being. I think most of us who were ever around him had this feeling of like, you're only ever going to meet one of these. this is a rare and blessed opportunity. So anyway, please raise your questions or comments. Yes.
What happened to the lizards that did get caught?
They would be moved outside the forest. They wouldn't eat, they wouldn't cook them all. No, they'd be exported.
So. I had the same trouble with slugs in my garden.
Yes, there's a lot of flying snails in my mother's, well, my late mother's garden, that they would whoosh, over the over the garden walls.
I've tried that, but they have a homing instinct. They all come back.
Well, it was quite, I think the back of her garden, it was like a solid brick wall, so that I guess they maybe there were some really dedicated ones that would go all the way up over the top and down again, but... It's difficult to know. I mean, I don't know that many accounts of people living with Ajahn Mun. I mean, the biggest, most thorough account is that of Ajahn Mahabur, but it's very much through the lens of his Ajahn Mahabur's experience. So it comes across when you read about Ajahn Mun in there, then Ajahn Mun's this kind of really fierce taskmaster and very kind of demanding and powerful. But it's also interesting how other disciples of his have taken issue with Ajahn Mahabur's account, because Ajahn Mahabur came along just 5 years before Ajahn Mun passed away. So he's the kind of the new guy that sort of showed up at the end. And other ones who'd been with Ajahn Mun a lot longer, or who'd known him for many years, they criticized that biography, because they said, well, there's a very slanted view, because actually Ajahn Mun was very witty. They said, you know, he was incredibly quick-witted, but you don't get there's not a single wisecrack in the whole of Ajahn Mahabur's. You know, Ajahn Mun does not do wisecracks. Does not make kind of jokes or clever remarks. You know, it's practice, practice, practice. You know, kill the kilesas. You know, meditate and destroy. You know. One of our branch monasteries, a monk actually had this picture of Ajahn Mun and had that as the caption underneath, meditate and destroy. So, but they say, Chalkun Viryan, who's still alive, he's very old now, but he was a novice with Ajahn Mun. And also in Ajahn Tate, in his accounts of being with Ajahn Mun, they had a very different picture, that he could also be extraordinarily gentle and very, very witty. Before he was a monk, he was a Mor Lum singer. And Mor Lum is a kind of local folk music in northeast Thailand. And it's a kind of, you do it as a competition. So you have two different singers, and it's improvised. And each singer has to try and finish their verse with a word that the other one's got to find a rhyme to, and you mustn't break the rhythm. So the musicians play, and then you have this sort of duel of improvisation. And Ajahn Mun was extremely gifted as a Mor Lum singer when he was a young lad, and so had his extreme facility with language and wit. And so that doesn't come across at all in Ajahn Mahabur's account, but if you read some of the things that Ajahn Tate or Chokun Viryan and others said, that kind of skill with language and his sort of quick-wittedness and also sense of humour was there in the mix as well. In terms of the content of the teachings, meditation methods, Ajahn Chah, he emphasised group practice a lot more. Ajahn Mun's style of his monasteries was, you know, go to Yukuti, meditate. So they wouldn't have morning and evening chanting very much. They would only gather if the Ajahn was going to give a talk or on the observance days for the recitation of the rules. But Ajahn Chah, his style of community life was quite different. So he very deliberately developed communal practice a lot and used that in communal work projects, whereas the style of Ajahn Mun and his monasteries was more go to your hut, sit, walk, and much less in the way of group practice. Also, Ajahn Chah had us learning a lot of the ceremonies, like all the paritta chanting and blessings and such like. So like in Ajahn Mun's monasteries, like Ajahn Mahabur or Ajahn Tate's monastery, they wouldn't do any of those. They wouldn't do house blessings or marriage blessings. They wouldn't know the paritta chanting like we do here. But Ajahn Chah encouraged the learning of those kind of things, even though that was sort of more the province of the village monks to do ceremonies and such, because he saw it was also made a bridge between the monastery and the local community. And so that was quite different. And so Ajahn Chah would be criticized by some of the forest Ajahns saying, oh, if you go to Wat Bopong, you know, they have all this group meditation, or you have to work all the time, or you have to go and do house blessings for these lay people. You know, do funerals and marriages. And so that was sort of the hardcore forest monastics would sort of look down on that and say, no, just meditate, meditate, meditate. But Ajahn Chah saw that there was a usefulness in that, because he saw that there was, in the village, there was a certain number of people that were like, they really understood the teachings and they wanted to meditate and they liked to come to the monastery, but a large chunk of people didn't. And that for them the teachings were very remote, that the monastery was something that was sort of in a way inaccessible or didn't really have much effect on their life. And so he saw that if you did house blessings or wedding blessings and such like, he went to funerals, it gave an opportunity for Dhamma talks. Because babies keep being born, people keep getting married, people keep building new houses, and people keep dying. And so, at those occasions, you'd have people coming together who are able to hear the Dhamma, where they wouldn't otherwise. And also, up until that time, like most of the Dhamma talks that they would get would be just like a village monk reading out of a scripture. That would be the talk. The Desana would just be a kind of, literally just read off a palm leaf manuscript. And so the kind of colloquial, instructive talk that relates to individual people's lives, and how they can actually learn to get on with each other a bit better, how they can use meditation to make their lives more improved. He saw it was ways to introduce those themes to people and open up the Dhamma to far, far greater numbers of people. So he developed that as a style within our community, so that we're quite different. So if you go to like Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, Ajahn Ben's monastery, Ajahn Tate's monasteries, then they wouldn't have any morning or evening chanting. They would the monastic community would gather at the alms round time, have the meal, and then everyone's off to their kutis, and you don't see anyone for the rest of the day. So it's a particular upaya or skillful means that Lumpur Cha developed, both for developing group practice as for monastics, and also making more of a accessibility of the teachings and Dhamma practice for the broader community. And one of the reasons why he encouraged group meditation and group practice rather than solitude was because he saw that he could quite happily be alone. When he was off on Tudong or living by himself, he had a great time just practicing meditation, and he saw that what was difficult was being with other people. And so he realized that he'd be off by himself for a few months and his samadhi would be really great and things would be fine. He'd have to go and stay in a monastery for a couple of weeks and then he'd be losing his temper, getting upset with people, criticizing and blaming, complaining. And he realized, I don't need more solitude. I need to learn how to live with people. And so then, because that's the way he operated, was that, okay, that's where I'm getting lost, so that's what I need to learn about. So then he deliberately used the situation of living with others as a training method for himself. And he developed so much benefit from that, then that became the style of his monasteries, with a lot of group practice. And then working together as a group. And so that then people would criticize that and say, yeah, you know, they'd think of it as an obstacle because it went against the sort of Ajahn Mun style. But it was very deliberate. And it's true, you know, when you do have to learn how to harmonize with others, you know, chanting, having your voice at the same pitch as other people. chanting at the same speed as other people. Nothing personal, of course. in the kitchen, you know, learning how to work together. Okay, who's the boss? Who's following? You know, what's my job? You know, am I fitting in with the other people? Am I here on time? Is it time to have a break? You know, just keeping your eyes open, learning how to fit in with others. You develop a lot of very, very practical mindfulness if you're just by yourself, just working by yourself or meditating by yourself, you don't get so much reflection. You can just follow your own preferences, which can be useful, and you can develop, you know, strength in that way. But But for Ajahn Chah, he realized he learned so much from the friction with others. Like, why is he so slow? Why is he so quick? And then learning to adapt and to work with others, then that became sort of the model for Wat Pa Phong.
You think that Ajahn Chah became so happy with people in the end of his time, like when he was alone in the Bodhi? He was, in the training, mm-hmm. that in the beginning was so difficult to be with the people. Mm-hmm. In the end of the his time, was very happy with people.
Oh yeah. I think it's hard to say, but I think there was that by the end of it, there was no difference. Yeah, it was just same. Okay, well, I won't keep us up till 1 a.m, so leave it there. Annamayang dhammagata sadhukarang dadamase sadhu sadhu sadhu.